Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife, especially in the spring. Scott Craven, our guest, he's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors, and it's good to have him back. What spring wildlife questions do you have? I hope you'll join in. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry, and hello to all of our listeners out there. Happy spring.
Yeah, happy spring. Birds are making their way back to Wisconsin. What are you seeing and hearing now in the skies?
It's a great time of year. Spring and fall, the shoulder seasons are my favorite time of the year. And, of course, there's a lot of things to see and enjoy out there as we get green up. I'd like the listeners all keep their fingers crossed that we get a little rain here in the next few days. I'm in Denver, as you know. And when I left last week, it was really dry around my yard, and I tried to get a few early things into the garden, and it was like planting in dust. But hopefully that will take care of itself over the next week or so from the looks of the weather forecast. But the birds have been back. The first redwings and cranes and the really early stuff was back, you know, over a month ago, 4th, 5th, 6th of March. But now most of the waterfowl have come and gone. As I drove across Nebraska 3 or 4 days ago along the Platte River, hoping to see the remains of some of the crane migration and snow geese and whatnot, not a bird to be seen. They'd already pulled out and headed north. So a lot of the migration is behind us, but as we creep up on May here, we start to get some of the insect-eating birds, the swallows and warblers and things like that back. And, you know, we'll still be seeing some bird species coming back well into May. So lots of bird activity. Not only are they coming back, but they're starting breeding activity. So the cardinals are singing and the turkeys will be strutting in the fields and probably have started that already. So there are interesting behaviors to watch. And there are, of course, the migration patterns. And it's not just birds either. Mammals have been out and about before I left on some of those beautiful days. Unfortunately, the possums and coons were getting active, and they pay the price for that activity with highway mortality from cars. But the frogs are singing. It's fantastic. The only downside was getting out. You know, a couple of weeks ago when the snow finally disappeared and I was out walking around my property, I realized, holy cow, I walked out the garage door and looked at the big bed of Asiatic lilies my wife really enjoys next to the house. And they were just the bed. I knew about this, but I'm just suggesting that as you make a walk in the spring, you realize what happened over winter. Anyway, the voles, the meadow voles, had just torn up that lily bed, just like it was rototilled. And they had tunnels branching out all across the lawn. Then I went across to the front of the house, and I've got a 10 or 12 foot arborvitae or white cedar on the corner of the house. And that looks like a palm tree now because the deer ate every bit of it they could reach. Then I proceeded around the corner over to my fruit trees and realized that all the lower limbs, because we had so much snow, that raised the rabbits up into the lower limbs of the apple trees. And they were all completely bare, completely debarked. And the list goes on. The point being that our interactions with wildlife, while the bird watching and so forth is generally on the pleasant side, there is some downside occasionally to some of these animals. And we have to use spring to get back in the swing of protecting our yards and gardens and things like that.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the subject of good things, Jan in Greenfield sent us some cool photos of a great horned owl hunting in her neighborhood. Any comments on those shots? They were nice pictures.
They were nice pictures. You don't get up close and personal with the great horned owl much because they're so nocturnal, but they're quite abundant and widely distributed. And that one, you know, who knows, when we see an animal out at a time of day when you don't normally expect it, we tend to think, gee, there's either something wrong with it. But in reality, different animals may be active at any time of day. And it looked like there's a pair, for example, in the pine trees I have on one boundary of my property, and they get rousted out every time we walk the dog through those pines and fly down the trail, and then a crow sees them, and then all of a sudden commotion breaks out and the owls are, you know, milling all around. So whether that bird in question in the photos was disturbed by crows or something else, or whether it was just hungry and out looking for a snack, we'll never know, but they were really nice pictures no matter what.
Judy in Racine has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question. During the winter, we had juncos, you know, all winter long, and then they up and left, and I couldn't tell you exactly when they left. However, we have three juncos who apparently didn't get the message, and I just saw them again. They were out eating birdseed. And are they going to stay, do you think, all summer, or do you think they're going to take off one of these days?
Well, I suspect they'll take off, but if they don't, no harm, no foul kind of thing. Among some of our more common birds, we have robins around Wisconsin that stay all winter. We see bluebirds during the winter. We see things during the spring and summer that we would have expected to move further north. So as you think about north and south, it's kind of a gradient. And while most birds of a species that's destined to head further north do head further north and are up there, there's always a few stragglers for whatever reason. And it's not that unusual. And if need be, they'll move on. It's kind of like people worrying about the straggler hummingbirds in the fall. You know, when are they going to leave? They're going to freeze. They don't have any food. But, you know, overall, they're just fine. And they, well, it's kind of a human term to say they know what they're doing. But generally speaking, the hummingbirds or robins or juncos have been involved in these migrations for many, many, many years. And it all works out. If they stay around, you get to enjoy them year-round.
Yeah. Absolutely. Judy, thank you for calling. Roy in Whitewater, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I call with a spring observation of what this has to be a winter phenomenon. I have a small choose and cut Christmas tree farm here, and this year, for the first time, I've seen browse on my balsam fir. I've seen it on oak trees before, I think, where apparently the deer just nibble off the tender little buds on either the oak trees in the past or this year, in many cases, the buds on these fir trees, which means they're not going to have growth this year. And I also see more deer droppings than ever on my property. I wanted to know if it's likely it's the deer that are causing it, kind of like the damage to arborvitae.
Yeah.
Well,
we
had a long and persistent snow cover, and it was pretty deep too. So, you know, the deer were a little stressed out, and balsam, I plant quite a bit of balsam myself. My main problem with the deer is the bucks beating them up in the fall as a spot to rub their antlers and get the velvet off, but they will browse on it occasionally, but it's an unusual circumstance. Among the litany of things that deer will eat, and it's a long list, balsam's way down at the bottom and what's often described as a starvation or a desperation food. It's about the last thing they'll take. Now, unfortunately for the grower or me or anybody else who's got balsam, that does set the tree back, and it can cause some deformation, you know, more so than pruning, but they will, as the grower knows, they will branch and put out new sprouts and so forth. And chances are they'll be okay down the road. I don't think that this is necessarily a sign that it's going to be a bad few years coming up. We have high deer numbers, or I don't remember. Deer Larry, where was this caller from?
Whitewater.
Yeah, so there are pretty high deer numbers in many southern parts of the state, and with what was left in the ag fields covered by deep, I think they probably turned to that as, hey, it's the only game in town. My arborvitae, on the other hand, they like the white cedar. And that's way up on the food preference list. So I can expect that kind of damage every winter, whereas with the balsam Christmas trees, it's an unusual circumstance. And I think he'll be okay in the future.
Here you go, Roy. Thank you for calling. Carl in Eagle River, your turn now. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. About 2 weeks ago, we saw a nice four-point buck, not in velvet, but just a nice four-point buck up here. And we're wondering if that's unusual for there to be a buck that held on to its antlers or if it's a common occurrence.
Well, it's not a common occurrence. It's unusual, but much like what we were describing for the bird migration, there's kind of a distribution over time where some bucks will start losing their antlers as early as December. And that's one of the reasons why there's some concern for some of the late deer seasons when bucks may be shot inadvertently because they appear to be does. So it can start in December, but it usually peaks through midwinter. And usually by March, pretty much everybody's dropped their antlers. But back when the DNR was surveying deer, counting them and looking around because of chronic wasting disease surveys, there were reasonably frequent reports of still seeing antlered bucks well into March. But now we're well into April. So the four pointer that you're seeing is way out on the far end of the bell curve of antler shedding distribution. So it is unusual. Most of the bucks that I watch around my property the antlers were long gone by latter part of February. And I think in early March, we had one 4 or 5 pointer that was hanging around the yard. And ultimately the dog found his sheds, and that was, I think, the first or second week of March. So yes, what you're seeing is a little unusual, but not unheard of.
There you go, Carl. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Elizabeth emailed, they have suffered a lot of downed trees last year around their pond near Drummond in Bayfield County and surrounding marsh and the creeks. And poplars and birches dropped for their branches. Several of their forest walking trails and a couple of their driveway areas seem related to beaver activity. They're not building dams. There is already a pond, but are digging channels and have two lodges. What can they do to control or maybe even get rid of some of these beavers?
Well, you know, the beaver, the species that they mentioned are prime beaver food, and the animals will cut those trees and fell them and then take the tender branches and whatnot and use those canals or channels they've created to drag the branches, float the branches, pull the branches, whatever you want to call it, back near the lodges where they use them as a food resource. You know, if it were 2 or 3 or 4 trees on the lawn of my cabin along the lake that I was really uptight about, I would protect the trees with a wire barrier, just put a cylinder around them, it could be 4 or 5 foot welded wire mesh, and just put a cylinder around the tree, and that would make it impossible for the beavers to do any damage. But if they're talking about an extensive, you know, natural growth that extends around a pond and along a driveway, that's probably a little labor intensive. So the other option is to get a hold of, I guess the place I'd start is with the USDA Wildlife Services office in Rhinelander, and talk to them about the current beaver damage program and whether they can get any assistance in removing those animals if they're so inclined, or just make sure that when beaver trapping rolls around again, that they've made contact with a local trapper or two. They could probably find somebody through their county DNR wildlife manager and have them lined up to come in and remove some of those animals. So they're sort of caught between the two decisions, the opposite decisions that many people have to make. If they enjoy seeing the beavers around or their lodge building or whatever, then they have to decide what's more valuable. Do they sacrifice the animals to save the trees, or sacrifice the trees to save the animals, because you can't, it just doesn't necessarily work to have both, because the trees are the animal's food source, or one of them anyway. Yeah. So those are the two options: tree protection or thinning out the beaver population. And there are a couple sources of help there that I mentioned.
Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife ecologist. It's great to have him back. And certainly if you have questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Jane Rotunda, our producer today. Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Questions, comments, experiences, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Scott, Jane Rotunda, our producer today, says she has two sandhill cranes walking down her street making a lot of noise. So they're really getting into today's show from the sound of it.
Well, it sounds like it. My daughter has, maybe Jane lives near my daughter in Verona, because she's been grumbling about, while she's out walking, there's a pair of cranes in the neighborhood just making they have a very loud and penetrating prehistoric kind of warbling call. And once people recognize what it is, then they never forget it. But if they're close by, it can get your attention in a hurry.
It can indeed. Glenn emailed, by the way, and wonders if it's too early to put out feeders in southern Wisconsin for hummingbirds.
Yeah, it's probably still a little early. We need to see a little more progression in green up. And, of course, I haven't been home now for 5 or 6 days, so I'm not sure what will be home shortly, but I suspect some things are budding out rather quickly. And once leaves are the size of a fingernail or whatnot, and some of the fruit trees begin to pop and so on, then sure, I mean, why not put it up? It's cool enough at night to make sure that the sugar water or instant nectar don't get moldy and whatnot. So sure, anytime now.
All right. Well, let's take another call. Austin in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Austin.
Hey, how are you, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I was just thinking back. I meant to call in earlier, but about 2 years ago, I live in downtown Wausau, and we had a black bear run up our tree in our backyard, and he was all groggy from being chased by the neighborhood kids, and we ended up feeding him bananas, and I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
Bananas. All right. What do you think of bananas for bears, Scott?
Well, bears are true omnivores. They have teeth that are much like ours, and they'll eat most anything that they think seems to be a food source. And I guess I'm not surprised that they'd eat bananas, but I just wondered how the bananas were being provided. Hopefully they weren't hand feeding the bear. But when you think about it, Larry, the tons and tons of human foodstuffs that are put out by people who are choosing to hunt bears by baiting as opposed to using dogs, you know, it's all sorts of things, from pie filling, maybe banana pie filling, who knows, but pie filling and candy and bakery products and assorted other things. So I'm not surprised they'd eat them. And I suppose fresh bananas are better for a bear than a big blob of pie filling. But anyway, still
go. Okay. Thanks, Austin. Appreciate your story. Appreciate it very much. Lois in DeForest, on to you now. Hi, Lois.
Hi, thank you. I was very surprised that on Monday I had two pairs of wood ducks surveying the woods behind my house near the O'Hara River. And I've had a wood duck house up for 3 years, no activity. But I think I think a female entered the house this morning, but I don't see the male anywhere. Would the male be kind of hovering nearby, or maybe the female isn't even in the house?
Well, if the female's in the house, Scott?
Well, you listed a lot of possibilities there. If the female is in the house, she may have just been in it for a short period checking out the accommodations. If she found them to her liking, she may be in there, or she'll start eventually the process of nesting. Either way, keep an eye on it and see if you see any additional activity. And the male will be around somewhere, but not necessarily very conspicuous. One of the things that folks will do these days, since motion-activated or trail cameras, as they're called, have become so prevalent, and some are quite affordable, you could put a camera up with a view of that nest box and have a pretty good record of what's going on as far as comings and goings of either the wood duck or anything else. So that's an idea that may keep you from standing at the kitchen window for long periods of time watching to see what's going on. But certainly having a wood duck box up is a great idea. Lots of people do it, but the wood ducks can be kind of fickle in terms of what they decide is suitable in terms of a natural tree cavity versus a wood duck box or some other possible nesting feature. But we'll keep our fingers crossed that your hen wood duck is setting up shop there, and then I think you'll probably see both members of the pair over the next few weeks or a month or two. So good luck.
Good luck. Thanks, Lois. Appreciate it. Susan in Fitchburg, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Good morning. I have kind of a mystery. I have a row of yew bushes in front of our house, and I know that rabbits and birds, and I think there's a feral cat, kind of hide behind there sometimes. But this spring, after the snow melted off of them, there's three separate places where someone has chewed a hole about 2 feet high, I would say, from the ground up, and left the yew branches there on the ground. And I'm just wondering who would do that. And there's certainly easier access points than trying to come through the front of the bushes.
So they chewed the bushes, the branches off the bushes, you're saying?
Right, like just to make a hole.
To get in, okay. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I guess so. It didn't appear that any of the needles were consumed or that there was any interest in feeding on them. It was just making a shelter, basically, in your opinion.
Yeah, because there's piles of the needles right at the entryway there.
And how big would you say the hole is? Big enough for a grapefruit or a basketball?
Basketball.
Wow. Well,
that's a mystery.
It remains a mystery, but with assuming that the snow cover was in there and it allowed any animal to get a little higher up into the yews or any other shrubs than they might normally be able to, the most likely culprit is probably a rabbit. Yews are, well, they're generally not a food source, but I could see something chewing its way in there. A hole that size, though, would not have been done by the voles that I mentioned as being the raiders of my wife's lily bed, although they might certainly seek shelter in that kind of a setting. But they're small enough to get in among the branches and would normally stay at ground level. And something bigger, like a possum or a cat, the cat that was mentioned, probably wouldn't do that and don't really have the dentition to do that very effectively. So I don't know the motivation necessarily, but I'm going to go with a rabbit.
I think you might be right on that one, Scott. I do indeed.
There are certainly other possibilities, but that seems to be the most likely one. And again, a solution to these kinds of mysteries is is the use of a camera for a couple of days to see what's now the animal's probably gone at this point. It was winter shelter, but come next season might happen again.
Yeah. There you go, Susan. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Well, Loretta in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Loretta.
Hi. My neighbor and I were trying to figure out why the Norway spruces have become carpet beneath them. What kind of critter does that? I mean, it's almost an inch thick. And just thousands of them. Is that a squirrel behavior or what and why?
So what's on the ground? The little twigs or?
Yeah, the terminal right. Section.
That's pretty common behavior for squirrels, especially red squirrels, that will go up into evergreens and cut off the tips of the branches, let them fall to the ground, and then gather up cones particularly, but sometimes buds, but primarily cones, and then lug those away to their food caches. And what's left behind is what looks like, well, what the heck? It looks like somebody went at this tree with a power pruning shears and was trying to shape it up. But obviously that's not the case with a big tree, but it's usually squirrels.
Yeah.
And they're small enough to get out on the branch, but not necessarily get all the way out to the flimsy tip, because a Norway spruce is pretty pliable on the very tips of the branches. So they go out as far as they can comfortably go and then just cut the twig and then go down and get whatever they want off of it after they've done some cutting. So it's likely squirrels.
Yeah, I've watched them do it, and they're kind of fun to watch, actually. Loretta, thank you. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
It's all fun and games until you have to rake up all the stuff that they've left behind to clean up the spruce. But again, that's all part of spring cleanup after wildlife during the winter have done their thing.
Let's take another call. Cal in Sugar Camp. Hello, thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm north of Rhinelander, and I was wondering about when do ermines start turning back into weasels? I mean, is it early March, late March? Is it now? I was just curious because I do have them around. I see the weasels, but I never see the ermines.
Well, ermine and weasel, the same thing. The term ermine, anyway, in both cases, it's a short-tailed weasel, but a long-tailed weasel exhibits the same color patterns. It's just a bit larger animal. But let's assume, just for the discussion, that we're talking about a short-tailed weasel, which is often called an ermine. But it could be an ermine in the summer or an ermine in the winter, or it could be a weasel in the winter and a weasel in the summer. It's the same animal. It's just a common name that's often applied to a short-tailed weasel and its winter pelage, its winter fur when they're snow white with a little black tip on their tail. And it comes from the description of ermine or the winter color phase of a short-tailed weasel or a long-tailed weasel, often being used as a dressing or decoration in Native American headdresses and other types of crafts, clothing, hats, things like that. That kind of thing's fallen out of favor a little bit, but it's the same animal. And with shortening days during the fall and cooler temperatures, that sets up the fall molt that takes the brown animal to white, and it doesn't occur instantaneously. It's a progression, so they look a little piebald as they proceed. And then in the spring, with lengthening days and warming temperatures, they change back. It has little to do with snow cover. So in a snow-free winter, a relatively snow-free winter, a white weasel or ermine is very conspicuous. But the white color change is designed to provide it with excellent camouflage during a normal snow pattern winter. And then they're brown in the summer when they need to be nondescript in a brown and green landscape. So
yeah, works out pretty well.
That's the long and short of it. It's a good thing for the ermine, but ermine and weasel are the same thing.
Thanks, Cal. Appreciate it. Russ in Stoughton, your turn. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. I have many bird feeders, seed feeders, and hummingbird feeders, and oriole feeders. And I noticed maybe for the first time in the last 3-4 years that downy-back woodpeckers, the little ones, the black and white ones, are landing on the oriole feeders, which have bigger beak holes than the hummingbird feeders, and they'll drink out of there. They might sit there for maybe 5 minutes or so, where the orioles might take 3-4 sips and fly away. And I'm wondering, is that unusual behavior for the woodpeckers?
Yes, I suppose you could describe it that way. I guess I've done on my nectar feeders or what I'm putting out for the orioles and whatnot. I've not seen the woodpeckers pay much attention to that. I know you were big into this, Larry. Have you ever seen woodpeckers using your?
No, I haven't. That's interesting, though.
You know, sometimes what happens is an individual bird or animal develops a taste or an affinity for something that is not typical of the species or general behavior, and they take advantage of it. And you may just have a woodpecker in the neighborhood with a sweet tooth, because typically they're on suet-based foodstuffs and also occasionally nuts, and they'll certainly use some sunflower seeds as well. But the nectar feeders, not so much. So sure, I would describe it as unusual, but not earth-shaking. Let's leave it that way, Larry.
Okay. Russ, thanks much. Ethan in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Ethan.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to mention that the DNR just signed up a bunch of lands for turkey hunting this spring through the Turkey Hunter Access Program. So there's lots of new places for hunters to get out and enjoy the spring turkey hunt.
Excellent. Oh, interesting. Yeah, excellent. Actually, I had kind of planned to ask you about the turkey season, Scott. Well, what are you thinking? Should it be a good year?
That's a pretty good segue into the turkey season, which begins, the first period begins on the 21st of this month. And I think, as people know now, since we've had a turkey season for quite a number of years, the season is broken up into 6 time periods, which used to be 5-day periods, but now they're a full week. So it's a continuous season from 21st of January until late May. But the hunters apply for one of those week-long periods and get a permit for that, and that's when they hunt. If they don't have a tag for a subsequent period, then they're done after their week has taken place. The permit applications for people to go turkey hunting took place back in December, and then the tags are sent out during the winter. And then just 3 weeks ago, I think it was March 15th, the additional tags that weren't sold or weren't allocated in the drawing went on sale as bonus tags. So hunters could call in and purchase a tag at the rate of one a day for usually later periods in the hunt if they wanted to extend their opportunity to hunt. I think there are still a few bonus tags or available tags for the later periods in May, and it's easy enough to find those on the DNR Go Wild license and permit purchase site. So there's still some opportunity, but the earlier periods are all filled up. The interesting thing was back during the bonus tag sales in March, I tried to log on to get an additional tag. And I think when it starts at 10 o'clock in the morning, everyone in the electronic queue is given a random number when they can enter the site. And I think I was number 3,500 or something. And I'd never been far in the pack. And the period that I was hoping to get was sold out before my number came up. And I think that much like many other outdoor activities, different types of hunting, fishing, boating, camping, hiking, recreational shooting all saw a pretty significant spike in activity during COVID over the last year or so, and that seems to still be carrying forward, as it seemed to me at least that more people were pursuing these turkey tags and looking for an opportunity to hunt turkeys. But it does open up soon. It should be it's always a great season. It's great to be out in the spring. It's typically the only hunting period or the only hunted species that takes place during the spring, and it's just great to be out there, as you know, Larry, and you see lots of interesting things you don't see at other times of year. I think the turkey population is supposed to be strong again, although, frankly, I just, in places where I used to see large numbers of turkeys at certain times of the year, I don't see as many as I once did, but the harvest stays up, so the turkeys must be out there somewhere. So go out there and have a good time if you got a turkey permit. And from the caller's advice, there's more open lands available, which you can likely find out the locations of on the DNR website under turkey hunting. So
I don't think there's any new regulations. I think
it's pretty much, Ben, you know, you're allowed for each tag, you're allowed one bearded or male turkey in the spring. And if you have multiple tags, you can take those turkeys as they present themselves. So, you know, some people really get into it and may have three or four permits. For many people, it's whatever they happen to draw for a period, and they hunt, and that's it.
What about non-hunters in terms of enjoying the outdoors, staying safe during that time period? I don't hear of many problems associated with that.
No, and I think the fundamental reason is there's the only hunters out there are turkey hunters, and the rationale behind these staggered periods was to distribute the turkey hunters over time so that there isn't a huge crush, like on the opening 2 days, like there is during the gun deer season. And there are far fewer turkey hunters than there are deer hunters. So when you take a smaller number and then spread them out over 6 weeks, there aren't that many of them out there at any given time. So the interaction or the opportunity to come in contact with the turkey hunter is not nearly what it is during the deer season. Plus, turkey hunters are restricted to shotguns, which have much shorter range than deer rifles. So one of the prime objectives of turkey hunting is using a call and literally talking with that turkey to try and get it to come close enough, you know, within effective shotgun range, which is at the outside probably 40 yards. So And certainly anyone hiking along or walking their dog, the turkey hunter is going to know that they're there long before they know the turkey hunter's there. And the odds are, because the turkey hunters are fully camouflaged, you could walk right by a turkey hunter and never know it. So I think the opportunity for negative interaction is probably greater on the side of the turkey hunter, where somebody might be out hiking or whatever and disturb the hunt, as opposed to any risk associated with people being in the field. Bottom line, get out there in the spring, you know, whether it's watching displaying turkeys or bird watching or just getting out and enjoying the spring wildflowers or hunting morels in a few weeks or whatever, you know, get there and enjoy it. And I wouldn't be too worried about the turkey hunting situation.
Scott Craven, our guest today, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. And boy, our lines are all filled, Scott. Let's go back to the phones and take another call. Vicki in Mount Horebits, your turn. Hi.
Hello, thank you. I could have sworn that I saw an orchard oriole in our tree a couple of days ago. Seems to me that's very early, because normally I don't see them until after the Baltimore Orioles have arrived. And then my second part of the question is, what is the lowdown on grape jelly? Yes or no? It seems like I read articles both ways, and maybe nobody really knows. So thank you.
All right.
Well, It is early for any oriole. I don't think you haven't seen any back, have you, Larry? I haven't been around long, but it's pretty early for that. An orchard oriole is a little darker than a northern, or I still call them Baltimore Orioles too, but technically I think the taxonomists now call them northern orioles. But the common ones we all see and enjoy, they're a little darker in color, a little more brownish rather than blaze orange. And we have seen, I don't remember them being especially common, and they're not common now, but I've seen them around my yard too. So first question is, we do have them around, but it is early to see one. But again, these things come over a lengthy period of time. So from the first arrival to the last departure, when we're talking about a migration, is quite a span of time, and somebody's got to be first. And I think that first orchard oriole apparently is in Mount Horeb. Anyway, as far as the situation, I've seen concerns about it, but frankly, all winter I watch for sales at the grocery store when you can get a 2-pound jar of inexpensive grape jelly for maybe 99 cents or something. And I stock up because I usually go through 8 or 10 pounds over the course of the feeding season. And it's what really brings the orioles into the yard. They seem to enjoy it. It's sugar basically. And it does seem to be very attractive to them. So I assume they're deriving benefit from them. I don't know what the downside would really be. So I don't know, Larry, does this issue concern you? You used to feed a lot of jelly as well.
I have a stockpile of grape jelly in my storage area right now. I've actually even experimented with other jellies, but it's the grape jelly that seems to attract them the best, and I don't really worry about any negative impacts.
Well, neither do I. So I would say Vicky about Horeb, I would say, go ahead and use the jelly. It's very effective. The birds seem to enjoy it. I think they do derive the, generally speaking, we tend to get a little worried about whether this or that is good or bad or what have you. But for the most part, whether it's bird, mammal, or anything else, they can tell and seem to know the nutritional, they seek out certain plant parts that are higher in nutrition than other plant parts, and they avoid things that are toxic or make them sick. So I'm going to give the orioles the benefit of the doubt on this one. Like Larry, I'm going to continue using the grape jelly and enjoying seeing the orioles around. So
there you go, Vicky. Thank you so much. Kathy in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you. I don't know if I've created a monster. I have about 40 grosbeaks. They've been coming into my feeders all winter long, and they're still coming. And I'm hesitant about keeping feed out because the bears and that. I live in northern Wisconsin, the Rhinelander area, out in the woods. And should I continue to feed them? Is there any food that they can get? I mean, they're very noisy. I have a lot of other bird species, but I don't want anything to happen to these. We've had a lot of clear cuts in our neck of the woods in the last couple of years, and our beard population in our woods has really increased. But
I really like grosbeaks. You're talking about evening grosbeaks, the yellow and black and white ones, which when a flock comes into your feeder, you better run to the store and get another bag of sunflower seeds, because those guys can really go through the seed. I used to feed big flocks of them when I lived back in northern New England, but I rarely see them around southern Wisconsin. I do get 2 or 3 pair of rose-breasted grosbeaks during the course of the summer, and I really enjoy having them around, but not evening grosbeaks. They're a little more north, and so Rhinelander is apparently enjoying them. I'd be tempted to just to enjoy them around and listen to them. They are noisy. They eat a lot of seed, but they're beautiful birds, and they're fun to watch. If I had them around, I'd still be feeding them for at least another couple of weeks, unless the bears became such a nuisance around the feeders that you had to stop for that reason. But I think we're pretty close to the point where the grosbeaks will be fine on their own.
Ah, there you go, Kathy. Thank you for calling.
you know, at some point, Larry, you kind of have to sit back and think of, you know, why am I doing this bird feeding anyway? And putting out all those 50-pound bags of seed. And when you come right down to it, yes, I mean, we'd all like to think we're doing something to benefit the birds in a tough time of year. But reality is a strong component of bird feeding is just wanting to have those birds around the house for the color and the sound and the activity and so on. So, you know, but we might as well face up to that reality. And if Kathy's still having fun watching those grosbeaks, I'd continue to feed them.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Kathy. Appreciate it. Norman in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Norman.
Good morning. I want to add to what your guest said about the damage in the winter. We have a small orchard and garden that's fenced with 1 by 2 inch mesh fence going down into the soil. And 2 years, not this winter, but the winter before, they absolutely decimated a number of young grafted fruit trees. They ate off a 4-inch diameter peach tree, completely girdled it to the ground, and up wow. about 4 feet or so. It looked like a beaver had attacked it. There were chips of wood all over the place. But I know no beaver was in it. There was no rabbits in it. There was no deer in it. I did see tunnels that looked about the size of holes made by mice, and I'm wondering if voles and mice are an interchangeable term, because I usually trap the mice in the fall, and apparently I didn't do a good enough job that year, because they even ate our hemlock trees, a 4 or 5 foot hemlock. They girdled them around near the ground. I've seen that before. And they also girdled our blackberry plants. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
Well, let's start with a little small mammal lesson, Larry. I know we've got a couple minutes here before noon, but the first issue is a mouse and a vole the same thing? And the answer is no. Even though with our voles, and there are several different species, one common name for them is a field mouse. They're not mice, technically. They're voles. They have short tails, a little different build, kind of a blunt, blocky face, and their lifestyle's a little different. The most common one is one called the meadow vole. That's the one that wrecked my wife's lily bed. And that's probably the most common one that the caller's having trouble with it is an orchard, in the orchard. And in certain years, meadow voles are unquestionably the most common numerically animal in the state. There can be hundreds and hundreds of them per acre of land in a good year. And I say a good year because voles tend to come and go on about a 4-year cycle. And I think this past winter, at least from what I'm hearing from the callers and what I witnessed, this was a good year for voles. And we had long persistent snow cover, which is good for voles because they're active beneath the snow where they're protected from raptors and so forth. Okay, so if it was a good year for voles and we had this good snow cover, then that yields the kind of damage that the caller reported. Heavy girdling of fruit trees and some ornamentals and other species to the point of literally killing them. And that can happen, too, on some species of conifers, as he pointed out. Back when I was actively working with the university, I'd get calls in bad vole years from commercial Christmas tree growers that the voles might have cost them 5, 10, 15, 20,000 trees in a plantation. Very often, Scots pine was one of the favored ones at the time, although that isn't as common a Christmas tree anymore. But anyway, they can cause a lot of damage, and trapping, which was what the caller said he should have done more of, may not have helped. They're so abundant that in order to knock them back, when they're that abundant, you need to be using bait stations with baits that are specifically formulated for vole control and bait stations that prevent the bait from being accessible to other species. Then you can knock them back a little bit. But it's a tough proposition. And a fence of that mesh size, the voles wouldn't even know it was there. So
yeah,
it's a fortunate circumstance, and we very often don't see the damage until summer, or spring rather, when the snow is gone. But then it's too late. So it's important to anticipate vole problems in the fall and try and do what you can then.
There you go, Norman. Thank you. Just a quick note here. Brian emailed. He finally realized the funny noises in the spring were from grouse and not vehicles running over rumble strips.
That does sound a lot like that.
He wondered if he could learn anything by recording frequency or duration of the drumming. No.
Not. I mean, it'd be interesting. Grouse drumming is another sign of spring and something people avidly listen for, and it's the basis for the DNR's population estimates on grouse. But beyond the curiosity value, I'm not sure there's much to be gained there.
Scott Craven, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today to answer your questions and hear your stories. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we will be back with Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Always great to have Scott come by, and certainly great to have you listening in. Questions? Our lines are all filled right now, but the number to call is 800-642-1234, and you can always email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. Just wanted to mention later this week, I hope you'll check in our blog at the Larry Mueller Show, that page. There's a new post about 5 heirloom seeds that you should be trying in your garden this year. And I'm going to give a try on a couple of those myself. You may want to as well on that blog. Later in the week, you'll be seeing that blog on the Larry Mueller Show page. So how's your garden? Well, you don't know. You're not home, so you don't know.
I planted a few things before I left, and hopefully they'll be up when I get back. But I just, as an interesting aside, I just noted during the news broadcast that Martin and Sons maple syrup operation up outside of Rhinelander is one of your sponsors. And I was there last week for a tour of the sugar bush with the owner, and boy, it was quite an eye-opening situation to see all that tubing and those beautiful maple groves and all of the stainless steel storage vats and the reverse osmosis and the cooking room. It was pretty spectacular. So that was it. That's kind of an interesting side.
Oh yeah, they're really. I've done that as well, and it's always really interesting to see the amount of time, work, and effort that goes into collecting that maple syrup. And I love maple syrup, so you have it.
It goes a long way toward explaining why it's an expensive and valuable product in Wisconsin forests. But it the whole process is just amazing. I often wonder how anybody discovered it in the first place. But as we go along, Larry, there are a couple of important dates coming up that if we get a chance to fit it in, that I'll offer up a few suggestions on things like the Conservation Hall of Fame induction that's coming up and a couple other things. But anyway.
Well, why don't we just do that right now, and then we'll go back to the phones.
Okay, well, that's fine. I just wanted to point out that we mentioned the turkey season opening on April 21st, and a couple of days later on the 24th, the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame is having its virtual induction ceremonies for the 4 inductees coming up, representing both last year's 2020 class of inductees, which couldn't be held because of COVID, and this year's inductees. So there are 4 people, some very well-known names like Stan Temple, Steve Bourne, Jens Jensen, and Gary Eldred. And it's free for people to be able to log in to hear those ceremonies. They're staggered throughout the day, beginning at 9 in the morning and going till 3 in the afternoon. And all someone would need to do is go to the WCHF.org, the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame website, and they could find the information to sign up if they're interested in hearing any of that. Similarly, the Natural Resources Foundation is now open for reservations for their very popular field trip program. I understand that a lot of them filled up, as it always does, very quickly in early April. But I had heard they had added some additional slots on the field trips now that COVID was easing up a little bit. And that's something else at wisconservation.org that people could check into and see if they could still get in on any of those, you know, couple hundred very interesting field trips. So let's see. And lastly, there was one other thing here. The DNR is still looking, I think, for volunteers for the frog and toad surveys. And it's always fun to get out there on a warm spring evening and listen to those frogs singing and make the contribution toward conservation. And lastly, here we are right in the middle of Keeping Wildlife Wild Week, which runs from April 4th and runs through the 10th. And if folks are interested in that, they can find ferret out some information on the DNR website. But, you know, every spring we often talk about what to do when you encounter an apparently orphaned baby something. And there's a whole week celebrating knowledge of that type, right, going on right now. So that's all I had, but just a couple of things I thought the listeners might find interesting.
Yeah, all good things there. Let's take a call now. Tom and Ocano will give you a chance. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
A couple of things. On your weasels, your long-tail weasel, Fernando, which has a much more wider distribution than ermine does, the short-tail. Right. You get down to southern Illinois, southern Indiana, they don't turn white in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's no continuous snow, it's a real disadvantage to stick out there in the open country.
You don't want to be.
The other thing is the early turkey season. I'm not much in favor of it and the staggered thing and having people in the woods with shotguns. At that time of year, you have woodland hawks like goshawks nesting, and you have somebody in the woods who's uninformed. And a goshawk, which is quite aggressive, you know what's going to happen to the goshawk with somebody standing there with a shotgun. And I've had several instances of losing females that way. You know, it's just, I don't know. People, seems like there's somebody in the woods hunting all the time.
Well, Tom, thanks for calling. Scott, a comment?
Well, I mean, we talked at some length about the relative, the lack of risk associated with the spring turkey hunting. It is an anomaly amongst hunting seasons in that it does occur in the spring, but as you well know, it provides a recreational opportunity for well over 100,000 turkey hunters, and the people who do participate in it, like you and I, are very passionate and excited about it. So I don't see that going anywhere too soon, nor do I see, you know, I've sat in the woods for many years in camouflage, as you have, Larry, and I've had deer step over my outstretched legs. And, you know, one of the things that is enjoyable about turkey hunting is being in full camouflage and other than calling, being very quiet and seeing all the other things out there. And I guess I think it's unfortunate to characterize hunters as being sitting there with a shotgun ready and willing to shoot anything that might fly by or pose some uncertain threat to them. So I think that that's a very low risk situation, both for other species and anyone who would shoot a hawk or protected raptor or anything else while they're turkey hunting would, not in my mind, be considered much of a hunter. So,
yeah.
I don't think that warrants any more conversation.
Kim in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Kim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it. I wanted to know, okay, so my dog has a really high prey drive, and she goes after rabbits like crazy, and every year we have a rabbit nest in our yard, and I want to know either if we can prevent that. I've heard that, like, cat litter maybe. I wanted to do something not, you know, with chemicals or whatever, but, like, cat litter, my dog scares away coyotes, so we don't have that, and I don't know if maybe we can attract like a raptor or something. And one of the problems is we live just north of downtown Milwaukee, so we're in Milwaukee. We live just north of, but it's like pretty busy area. I don't know what like options we have, especially if to attract a bigger bird,
or to keep rabbits out of your property.
So you would like to not have rabbits on your property because the dog gets them and so forth. That's the question.
Yep.
But you're not worried about the dog catching one or what have you. It's just
she gets one at least. And when there are nests out there, she finds them before we do. she gets at least one a year.
But you view that as a problem. You'd rather not have that.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I am afraid you're trying to prevent something that's very difficult to prevent. You know, short of the proverbial rabbit-proof fence around the yard that might keep them out, they're very persistent at penetrating fences, digging under them. And the problem with a rabbit nest is that it can be hidden in plain sight. People find them every spring when they start mowing the lawn, and all of a sudden, gee, right out in the middle of the lawn, what's that little disturbed area? Oh, there's some dead grass here. And you pick it up, and lo and behold, there are four or five helpless nestling rabbits in that nest, out in the middle of the lawn. Certainly some are hidden back in the bushes or on a fence line, but the female rabbit will have her young in a shallow depression, scratched right out in the turf, and then covered, and then she visits them at night to nurse them. Those are very, very difficult to prevent. And most people who are trying to protect their gardens and landscape plants, when such a nest is found, are placed in the immediate dilemma of, oh, they're so cute, but look at the little bunnies, and what should I do? When in fact, the little bunnies are future garden and landscape problems. So that's a difficult annual dilemma for anyone with a yard. But frankly, short of diligent fencing and maintenance and potentially the spreading of some things that rabbits find obnoxious, like naphthalene flakes, or ammonia, other things that other things find offensive, I really think that in this case, you're ahead of the game by just letting nature take its course, so to speak. If the dog finds a nest, you know, so be it. Because you're really fighting an incredible uphill battle to try and prevent a rabbit nest somewhere in your yard. They're that common. And they're that well hidden. And that's one of the reasons why they're so successful reproductively. They have a number of litters. They're very good at protecting a nest by concealing it. And frankly, I think it's a long shot to think you could make any headway that would justify the effort you would have to invest.
There you go, Kim. Thank you for calling. Werner in Oconomowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Werner.
Good afternoon. I've got a comment and a question. First of all, my comment is that I read somewhere, but I haven't tried it yet, about putting out partially peeled bananas for orioles and other birds. And the question I have, more importantly, is we just moved into a house last year, and the turtles seem to be digging up and planting their eggs in our flower beds. When is that typically going to happen, and is there any way to avoid having them tear up the flower beds?
Wow, that's a couple of interesting questions. As far as the banana situation is concerned, I've heard that, but I've not tried it myself either. But putting out a piece of ripe banana For example, on my jelly feeder, I have a couple of angled nails that I put a half orange on. Those are also very attractive to the orioles. But, you know, this spring, Larry, I think I'm going to put a banana on one of those nails and see what happens.
Me too.
I don't see any reason why it might not work, and we found out earlier in the program that bears apparently like them, so let's give the Orioles a shot as well. If it works for you, call us back on a subsequent program and let us know. As far as the
turtle nesting in the flower beds.
I thought you were headed in a different direction with that question, because a disturbed soil bed where the soil is loose and easily dug is very attractive to nesting turtles. But they're very adept at recovering the eggs and patting it down such that you hardly know the nest is there. And it's only if the turtle's disturbed and abandons the nesting effort that you end up with any hole at all. Around my cabin up in northern Wisconsin, I would say we were up there a couple of weeks ago and probably found, I would say, at least 40 turtle nests around the garage and kind of backyard area where the turtles come up from a small wetland. And these had all been dug up and eaten, probably by raccoons, but probably I also saw a gray squirrel foraging around there. I don't know what dug them up for sure, but they were all depredated. So in many cases, people will find these nests or see the turtle laying the eggs, watch the interesting process, and then actually want to figure out how to cover or get some help figuring out how to cover the nest with chicken wire to protect it from being depredated by the predators. So most of the damage that you'd see in a flower bed, in my opinion, comes from the possums, coons, skunks, and other things that indiscriminately tear the nest up and leave the hole and the destroyed eggs scattered around. So I think the only what would deter the turtles from laying in the first place is a very low fence, maybe only 4 or 5 inches high, made out of hardware cloth or whatever, around the bed. That would solve that problem. But they're still going to try and nest somewhere around there. If you want to protect the nests, you can. But I think it's the subsequent predator damage that really causes the problem that you're finding offensive. And it's very difficult to do about that.
There you go, Werner. Thank you so much. Ralph in West Allis, it's your turn. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. I had a question from one of our complex neighbors. She's a bird watcher. And in the complex, here's a hen turkey walking around. And she was concerned that the turkey separated from the flock because she was sick. And I said, I think she's probably looking for a nesting site, because south of her apartment is an old orchard. And I think maybe we used to have coyotes here, which I don't think the turkeys would be staying here if they still were here. But what about the fox that we have around here? Will the turkey be safe nesting with fox around?
Well, the first part of the question is, what's the turkey doing there? And it could very well be looking for a nest. And the flocks do break up or start to break up soon or throughout the spring as turkeys drift out of the flocks to establish a nest site. So I wouldn't be worried about it being sick or separated from its colleagues. They wander all over the place, and they do very well in suburban environments. So no problem there. It's fun to see them wandering around. If it has a nest, then it's got all sorts of things to worry about, whether it's coyotes, raccoons, feral cats, possums, skunks. There are a lot of things that would go after the eggs. But the hen is very well camouflaged. The nest is usually very well hidden, and some turkey nests are depredated, but some certainly get through to produce young. And there's probably not a great deal you can do about that. There are always concerns with bird nests that some are lost to predation, but there's not much we can do in most cases. If you happen to find the nest, certainly alert the neighbors to keep their pets or children or grandchildren away from it. But beyond that, there's not much you can do.
Here you go, Ralph. Thank you for calling. Marie in Northern Price County, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I've got two kind of observations. One is about deer, and I do the summer deer surveys. So last July 27th, I saw a newborn fawn with its mother in Sawyer County, and that was fairly late. I just sat and watched the two of them, but it was a newborn fawn, probably a day old, 2 days old. So I thought that was fairly late.
It
and
is.
The second observation was just now, because I'm out and about in the woods a lot, just saw a snapping turtle, pretty big size snapping turtle, walk along the power line on the wood edge.
Nice observation.
Nice observation. The fawn's a little late and the snapping turtle's a little early, but, you know, it like many of the events that we've talked about, they start, I remember when people used to call me about fawns when I was working. The earliest I recall was literally Easter weekend when someone had found a fawn in their tulips. And that's very early. The peak of fawn drop is around June 1st, but it stretches out throughout the summer. I've seen them or heard of them as late as even in well into August. So it does happen. But most are dropped within a several-week period around the 1st of June. And as far as the old turtle, I don't know where it was headed. It's pretty early for a female to be out wandering around. It was probably just looking for a new home. A lot of places are very low water around the state because of the dry conditions and high fire danger, so it may have just been out and about looking for a new body of water to live in.
We have, thank you, Marie, by the way, John in Port Wing wonders, he's got flying squirrels on his bird feeder, emptying it every night. Would adding red pepper flakes deter them?
There are some commercial products that use the chemical basis for, you know, hot pepper sauce. It's called capsaicin. And in a bird supply place like Wild Birds Unlimited or others, they sell a powdered product of that hot pepper ingredient. One of the trade names is Squirrel Scram, but I think there are lots of others. And when that's added to seed, it supposedly does not deter the birds, but will deter the squirrels. Now, so as flying squirrels are concerned, I know many people would be just thrilled to be able to watch flying squirrels in the evening around their feeder. But if they're eating too much seed, give that hot pepper powder a try. I don't know that the flaked stuff would work because it's not
powdered better.
I think the powder would. So good luck with that.
Scott, thank you so much. I think you'll be back, not the first Wednesday of June, but June 9th. We're looking forward to it. Thank you again for being with us. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, emeritus professor at the UW, our guest. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.